Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Please join me in welcoming Phyllis Schlafly!
They say that women are like tea bags. You don't know their strength until they get into hot water.
We need to talk about the threat of the women's liberation movement. So let me be clear. I am not against women working outside the home. That's their choice. What I am against is a small elitist group putting down homemakers. They want to create a sex-neutral society, which will mean that women are going to find themselves with two full-time jobs. So you need to tell your senators you want them to vote no on this Equal Rights Amendment so we can have a country that we are proud to leave our daughters.
Hello and welcome to the finale episode of Still Watching Mrs. America. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us for this last episode of this little mini-series we're doing, what Richard and I like to do on this podcast is every week we break down one episode of a show that we are currently sort of watching closely or obsessively. We are finishing up our run on the FX on Hulu series, Mrs. America. And then after this episode, we are taking a break for a couple months and we'll be back in the fall. So, you know, we are end of an ERA era, end of our, recording this podcast for just a little while, but we will be back.
I got appointed to a cabinet position.
I was told I was too divisive to get a cabinet.
Well, no, so I all men are given a special phone and sometimes it rings and you just get jobs and stuff. It's great.
Cool. Not what happens for women, as it turns out. All right. So if you haven't been watching along with us, we've been really lucky to have a bunch of great interviews, throughout this mini series. And this episode is no exception in that we have a threefer for you. We've got, Stacey Scherer, who is one of the executive producers on the project and sort of had the idea for the show in the first place. She's got some great insights to share with us. We've got the return of showrunner Dobby Waller and the return of series stars Cate Blanchett. So one, two, three. Great stuff for you to listen to. But first, you're going to have to listen to Richard and me talk about a few things, as well, our thoughts and feelings in this finale. I wanted to kick off by bringing up something that you wanted to mention last week, Richard. I know you really loved the episode Houston and, you wanted to shout out the director of that episode.
Yeah, Jenixa Bravo, who is really good. She made a movie that was at Sundance a few years ago called, Lemon. And then this year at Sundance, she had, a kind of a bigger, more buzzy film, called Zola, which was buzzy partly because it was the first ever movie, based on a Twitter thread. The style and the sort of tone you see in that movie, I think is well mirrored by, the Houston episode of this show. She's just got both a real visual style, but also a really keen touch with actors. As we saw with, you know, Sarah Paulson's great performance, as well as everyone else in that episode. So, I didn't even realize that she had directed it, because sometimes our screeners don't have full credits on them. So I just wanted to retroactively, compliment, Bravo, because, say Bravo to Bravo, because, yeah, I mean, she just really kind of knocked it out of the park.
Excellent. So, check out, Lemon, if you haven't already, and then look forward to Zola whenever that might be released. We also got a couple emails. A couple of them are about this interview that Gloria Steinem gave to The Guardian about the show. And we are going to address that a little later on in the episode. You can always email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. You can email us over the summer if you miss us, if you want to tell us what you're watching, if you want to make suggestions for what we should pick up in the fall, because we haven't decided yet, you know. So take a look at the release calendar. If you see anything in September that you think you would love to hear us talk about, let us know. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I do want to read a little bit of this email from a listener, Bill Cody. The title of the email is "I Knew Phyllis Schlafly." Bill talks about being on the speakers board at Washington University in the 70s and about how you know, conservative students at the school really wanted conservative speakers, how a lot of the conservative speakers were both too expensive and like unlikely to fill the room, that they needed to fill for the Speakers Bureau. So, someone they, went to a couple times to sort of meet this demand was Phyllis Schlafly, who did not, require a speaker's fee. Because she went to law school there. So all she asked for was, a lunch. And Bill concludes this email, "The problem with Schlafly, from someone who actually met her a few times, is that she was disarmingly nice in person. I think the show is doing a good job with that, and maybe people will learn something about why it is important not just to shout at your opponent. Sometimes you catch more flies with honey. Not sure the new left has figured that out yet. Keep up the good work, Bill." So that is actually a theme that will come into play directly in this episode, the idea of how abrasive is too abrasive, sort of thing. But I thought that was, interesting from Bill. And, you know, like I said, we are going on hiatus for the summer. So if you have any other thoughts about the show, you can't necessarily, get them on air, but I still love to hear them. I know people were waiting for the finale to sort of see how they felt about how everything wrapped up. So I guess I'll just, start there with you, Richard, and, you know, we're going to get into some specifics, but in sort of like a general way, how do you feel like this finale lands the plane of this series?
I cried. I like cried like kind of a lot at the end. Just because it is such a, I thought it's such a lovely, X amount of steps forward, X amount of steps back, kind of just weary acknowledgement of how these things work. And I think that, you know, the end with the Steinem speech about, like, you know, that we'll make more strides when we reveal, you know, when the full potential of ourselves is revealed. I'm not quoting it, but, like, you know, something like that. Like, I just think that the sentiment, was nice, even though dark things for one side of the argument, happened in this episode and indicated toward a lot of dark things to come in the, you know, 40 years since.
Right. This is, I think I knew a lot of people who were like sort of dreading this episode because, the Houston episode is fairly uplifting, even though it does have a sort of ominous end to it. And I think people were worried that this finale titled, Reagan would be just a real downer of an episode. And I think they modulated the tone of it really well. And I don't feel dispirited watching it. I feel galvanized. So that's, yeah, you know, that's where I landed. We'll sort of get into the specifics of how they did that. I wanted to start though with the Alice character, because I know this is something you had a question about at the end of last week's episode. Like, will we see, you know, a payoff for Alice's journey that she goes through in this episode? And we get sort of, two stories here. We get Alice's story and Pamela's story. And both of these are, you know, not, it's loosely based on real life women, but not actual real life figures. And for Pamela, who sort of sticks to Phyllis's advice, we get, a sad ending, I would say. And for Alice, we get something else. Richard, how did all that play out for you?
Well, yeah. I mean, what did Pamela say in the Houston episode? If I go home, I'm just going to get pregnant again. And where, what do we see? She's got, she's got another baby.
Yeah.
Which, you know, what a miracle, but also she didn't want it. And, you know, she's back working in the trenches for Phyllis, who seems to be punishing Pamela for her husband's outlook on things and her husband's behavior and saying, well, if you want to go to that, like you did go to this event, like you need to treat your husband differently. You know, Pamela has really been, ground into the dirt by the machine that is both the ideology she's working in support of, but also particularly Phyllis, who, you know, I think her bigger ambitions are laid more bare in this episode than they have been in the past, thwarted as they may have been ultimately. Whereas Alice, you know, I think it was something crucial that Paulson pointed out, in our interview with her last week is that, like, you know, the episode Houston doesn't end with Alice forsaking everything that she believed. She just has her thinking a bit more comprehensively about it, maybe, and a little bit more fairly about the other side. And so I believed that Alice would come back to the carriage house where the, you know, the Stop ERA headquarters is set up and try to help more and just, I mean, try to kind of return to things as normal, even though her mind has been, cracked open a little bit more. And then, you know, find her way toward, an assertion of independence at the end. And it's not, you know, I think that a lesser show might have had her do, you know, taken some big job on the other side of the argument or, you know, just kind of transcend the station she'd been in kind of grand fashion. But instead, no, I mean, she's still, you know, picking up Phyllis's daughter and, just the, you know, taking care of her grandkids, but also she got a job and just, you know, for 411, you know, nothing sexier than that. it's just, but it's something, you know?
Yeah.
And, I think that that was a really, I think both of Pamela's and Alice's sort of outcomes were, measured ways to imagine where some women who were caught up in Phyllis's momentum, might have landed after she kind of blew through.
Right. And this idea that, like, you know, when they have their sort of, they have, I guess, kind of three confrontations in the episode, but the middle one, with some alcohol involved, Phyllis says something like, I did this for you. You know what I mean? And Alice is like, no, I mean, no, you did not do this for me. Like, we know that this series, starts off with Alice being the one to bring the ERA to Phyllis's attention. But this idea that Phyllis did any of this for anyone other than herself is patently untrue, at least in this depiction of it, I think. It's sort of like that moment at the end of Breaking Bad where Walter White, you know, at first is like, I did this all for my family. And then eventually he's like, no, I did this for me. You know, that's what Alice is trying to get Phyllis to see. So, yeah.
The important thing is that it's okay that she did it for herself. It's okay to do that. You know, it's okay to have these big ambitions. The problem is the, apparatus she used to get there. And the ideology she used to get there, as is pointed out briefly in the scene where she's confronted after taking the LSAT, that it's hypocritical, you know? So I think that the show was really smart and correct in, letting Phyllis mourn a little bit for the thing she wanted and didn't get and not punishing her entirely for wanting that thing. But certainly still questioning, her means and motivations.
Yeah, and I do want to say that that moment at the LSAT, which kicks off the episode, there is a photo in the Chicago Tribune in 1979 of Phyllis Schlafly in that wig. You know, that is as is many of the unbelievable things that happen in the show. That is something that actually happened. You can go read about it in the Chicago Tribune that Phyllis wore a wig to, you know, to school. So there you go. And there's this also this.
Sorry. Those wouldn't have been the LSATs. They would have been the bar exam.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sorry.
There's also this Trumpian lie, this very Trumpian lie she tells about her crowd size in Houston, right? That sort of kicks off the episode. It along with like a zoom in on a Reagan button that uses the slogan, Make America Great Again, are like the two most overtly Trumpian along with like mentions of like Paul Manafort and Roger Stone, or appearances by convicted felons, Paul Manafort and Roger Stone. But like, that's the most overtly Trump moment for Phyllis in the series. And I appreciate, and it's also based in reality. And I appreciate that the show has kept its foot off the pedal a little bit when it comes to drawing those parallels, because I think a lighter touch makes them land that much better. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I mean, it is funny. Like, I knew that Make America Great Again was not an original slogan to the Trump campaign. But just seeing it on that button, I was like, oh, these motherfuckers don't do anything. They don't have any of their own idea. You know, like, it's kind of like when Melania gave the speech and people were like, this is plagiarized wholesale from Michelle Obama. Like, for Christ's sake, you people. You know, I mean, I think the Reagan administration, the Reagan candidacy, or the campaign was its own brand of stupid. So I'm not saying that like they were there, it was some genius strategy that then Trump just stole. I mean, and they're both idiots in the different ways, but, yeah, it was jarring to remember, like a lot of great period shows do, that like past is prologue, so much of the time.
So the big set piece for the first half of the episode is this, ERA Follies, thing that, actually did happen. This funeral that Phyllis Schlafly threw for, the ERA. And, you know, you can read all about it in the New York Times. There were two women dressed up as Bella Abzug and Gloria Steinem. They did get up and sing a song, though they sang like a parody song from Auntie Mame. And instead, this version came up with its own song, Two Little Feminists Are We, a Gilbert and Sullivan parody. Let us listen to showrunner Davi Waller talk about her, the creation of that song, and sort of her thoughts on the finale overall.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Titled Reagan, and I don't want to like read too much into it, but are we meant to take some sort of like the era of the women's movement is over and this episode is after a man?
Yes, that's exactly what you're supposed to take away. The party is over, guys. Reagan is in. The backlash is firmly taken hold.
So
the real crash after Houston.
Yeah, I don't know. That being said, you know, I just thought it was, I think it's interesting, you know, obviously at this point, there have been plenty of discussions around this show and whether or not people feel like the depiction of Phyllis is appropriately critical, et cetera. And I was just wondering if it felt important to show that even in her victory that she gets in this episode, Reagan gets elected, the ERA is, she holds a wake for the ERA, but it's a big moment of defeat for Phyllis. Was that important for you, to end the series on that note for her?
Yeah. I thought that ironic twist, you know, the feminist leaders lose and it's a tragedy. And normally in this kind of show, the Phyllis character would be victorious and reap the rewards. But because she's a woman, she also loses. And that's very much the point.
Yep, feels right. All right, so I feel that in my bones. So based on your recommendation, I signed up for subscriptions to newspaper.com.
No, I love it.
Very enjoyable. And you know what's really funny? That if you go into newspaper.com and you read an article that someone else has clipped, you can kind of see that they've clipped it. So occasionally I'll like stumble on an article that you clipped for the show. It'll be like, Dobby clipped this. So I'm like, this day. I was like, oh, I'm on the right track. Yeah, exactly. I'm like,
oh. That's hilarious. You have so many clippings.
It just made me always feel like
a bunch about the pie.
Yeah, exactly. It just made me feel like I was on the right track.
Joanna Detective on the hunt. Yes, you're on the right path.
But so I was like, I was reading the various articles and reportings on this Follies that was put together and depicted in this episode. And I was like, surely they didn't. And I was like, oh, they did.
That is all true. You're like, surely they didn't have an impersonator for Bella and Gloria singing a song. Oh, I guess they did.
They did. But so I was reading that and I was like, well, is it this song? But it was like a different song. They had two people portraying Bella and Gloria, but they're singing a different song. So I want to know how Two Little Feminists came to be in your version.
So we forget why we didn't use the actual song, but I said to Joshua, who co-wrote this episode with me, I was like, I know you have an inner musical theater person in you. What can you do? We knew we wanted to do that song, that particular song. And I was like, we just love the song. It's public domain and it worked and it was funny. I was like, I know you can come up with good lyrics. And he's like, oh, I couldn't possibly. Oh, I couldn't. And then like the next day, he sends me this perfect song in my inbox with these lyrics. And I thought he did a beautiful job. And it was just one of the highlights of the shoot was watching Melanie Lynskey sing the song. It was amazing. Because you know Rosemary would have.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that I love that seems a slight, ever so slight tweak on history that you give in this episode. So there's a lot of large scale carnage, of course, that Phyllis is responsible for. But the personal wounds that she inflicts, especially on Eleanor, really land hardest with me. These like personal, slight is too hard a word, just cruelties. And so you give Eleanor this little moment, where she meets a gentleman outside after the bomb scare. And so then I like went and looked it up and I was like, did Eleanor like find? And then I couldn't find anything that, any evidence that she might have had a gentleman friend. So can you talk about that choice for her?
We all really loved Eleanor. We did read that she had boyfriends, but we thought, when did she possibly have the time? She's always taking care of the children at her home and, you know, helping out the Schlafly's. But we felt, I guess, and maybe this is us being sentimental in the writer's room, but we really wanted to give her some hope and have a moment where she's like, you know, when Phyllis gives that speech about these are my six jewels and I've raised them, and Eleanor sitting there, that we just thought, wouldn't it be wonderful when she's in D.C. if she, you know, like they're Phyllis's jewels, they're not mine, and I deserve a life. And so we definitely fictionalized that encounter, but I really loved it. And Jean is so wonderfully heartbreaking. You just love her. And that smile she gives at him is just too much.
Thank you for it.
Yes. Yeah. I'll call us sentimental, but someone needs to have a happy ending. And why not Eleanor?
Exactly.
Eleanor and the other one that we wanted to highlight is Willie B, Phyllis's cook. That there's that scene in the finale where she talks about, I guess I could write a cookbook. I have so many recipes. She did self-publish a cookbook in 1984 called Blue Ribbon Recipes. And there was a chapter on bread, pies, and cakes.
Oh, that's so cool. That's great. I love the detail.
Yeah.
I know that you made a decision in advance of filming the series not to be in contact with any of the folks, real-life folks who were involved before you made the show. But what is, you know, I actually kind of want to specifically ask about Jill Ruckelshaus, the fact that she has said that she watched the show, she likes the show. What does that mean to you as someone who put this together as sort of a love letter to this time in this era?
It means everything to me. First of all, I absolutely came to love Jill Ruckelshaus in writing for her, and she is every bit as wonderful as she appeared to be in the 70s, I have to say. It really is very validating, you know, when she said that she often made overtures to fellas and always felt rebuffed, and she was trying to get at the, you know, there must be, does she really believe in what she says? It was really validating because we really did rely on primary sources and reading what these women said back then in the 70s and extrapolating these encounters that obviously have to be imagined because there's no record of them. Although they really were, I mean, Jill really did moderate that debate that Phyllis did at the National Press Club. They really did cross in that moment, but we imagined the conversation that they would have. So it was really great to hear that that felt real to her and that the dynamics of the feminist leaders, when she said, oh, Betty was trouble and very rude. I just thought, yeah, that is pretty much what we read about. That meant a lot to me. It was quite gratifying.
I know you talked about how you wanted the show to be sort of the various moments that these women sort of touched each other, and crossed paths, and you didn't want to really invent any of it. But was it ever tempting to invent some sort of more meaningful interaction between Gloria and Phyllis?
So many times. Like, what if they just debate? What if we just make up a debate? I mean, that would make the storytelling much easier. And also, Kate and Rose, like, you'll want them to be in the scene together. These are two most brilliant actresses working today. But it just didn't feel right. And we always felt we had to follow the true events and be, even though we imagined, you know, conversations, but be true to the emotional truth of what these characters and people went through. And since Gloria had said she would absolutely not debate Phyllis and didn't want to give her any airtime, it felt untrue to put them in a room together when that was Gloria's entire philosophy about Phyllis. It felt like it was telling the wrong story. So it definitely was tempting, and it would definitely make our lives easier. But we had to really be creative about making the story the fact that Gloria never encountered Phyllis. And whether or not that was the right thing or not to do, you know, and Betty kind of calls her out on that, their final scene together in the finale. So we made that the story. We made what was difficult storytelling into the story itself. And we also made a part of the story that it would be frustrating for Phyllis that Gloria ignored her. Like, I think it must have gotten to Phyllis that Gloria just always ignored her and refused to ever appear with her when she sees herself as on par with Gloria.
Right.
And you have to wonder if maybe Gloria was right, because today very many people confuse Phyllis Schlafly with Anita Bryant, and she's often a footnote in history, whereas everyone knows who Gloria Steinem is. So maybe not wanting to share her spotlight was a smart move. And so we wanted to honor that.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's comforting. It's comforting the number of people actually who I've talked to who hadn't heard of Phyllis Schlafly, but I also think that it's so valuable that the show is saying, okay, but don't forget these sort of insidious forces that can come and shape an entire political landscape for generations to come. You know,
that's right. They're going to be reactionary forces every generation, and they're going to look a little different than Phyllis, but they're going to have the same, influence. And we can't ignore the backlash leaders, because they have changed the course of where this country has gone, as we've seen.
Something I remember you saying at the Television Critics Association press tour was that, and subsequently, that you didn't want to tell people what to make of the show, that you really wanted them to, you know, make their own choices when it came to how to process the show. That being said, you know, is there...
Like, that sounds like me. That's something I would say. I'm a consistent person.
Is there a reaction that you've been like, you know, other than obviously Jill's great reaction, is there a reaction from, you know, the general audience that you've been particularly proud of or gratified by?
Yes, I've had a number of people text me that they watched the show with their moms, and it has led to deep conversations with their moms about this time period and their mother's experiences during this time period, and learning a different side about their mother. That has been incredibly gratifying, especially since all the writers and, and myself have talked with our mothers in the course of making the show about their experiences and felt closer to them because of that. I also feel really, it's really gratifying to hear the number of women, young women, who feel galvanized to fight, who have discovered new role models in the women in the show. That has been really rewarding. You know, I set out, I wanted to be a writer to make people feel and to provoke meaningful conversations. So the fact that those conversations are happening is really all I ever hoped for.
We see in this episode this, you know, both via Phil Crane and then, you know, the folks working for Reagan, that this question of, is Phyllis building this mailing list, or is she capitalizing on the ERA movement just so she can build this mailing list, just so she can sell it to someone? And we see that made even more explicit when it is treated as this extremely valuable commodity in this race. Do you think this was her long game the whole time?
I do. I do, because I think she was a very brilliant grassroots organizer, and she was a very strategic thinker. And mailing lists are very valuable. They're still valuable. You know, Obama's network is very valuable to the next Democratic nominee, right? That's his coalition building. So, and she was so guarded with the list. You know, the fact that she wanted to have control over all her supporters and have everything be run through her is someone who understands the value of their base. I don't know how you would build a coalition she built without an eye towards using that as leverage in some way. So I do think she knew what she was doing. And I think the feminist leaders were right to call her out on it too.
Yeah.
Very smart of them.
A couple people have mentioned, and I think you've mentioned as well, that, you know, the original episode order size is smaller and that the story kind of kept expanding and expanding until you have 9 episodes here. What was being added in that expansion?
You know, once, as I think I mentioned this on our first interview, that we had sold the show to FX in late 2015.
Right.
Once the 2016 election happened and I pivoted to have the show be this broader story about the country's move to the right and the birth of sort of cultural wedge issues and the origins of our cultural wars, it became clear that we would need more episodes to tell that story. So that was the point in which it started ballooning to 9 episodes. That was when I was really became interested in spending more time with the women's convention and the state meetings leading up to it. That's when I added the episode about Jill and wanting to tell the story of the 1976 convention, which is not, it's important to the battle of the Equal Rights Amendment, but it's very important in telling stories of the shift of this country to the right and the takeover of the Republican Party by the far right. So that's when it started to get bigger, because it was a broader story that I wanted to tell.
So other than expanding Jill's character, you know, into her own episode, are there any other characters that you felt needed to be expanded in wanting to address sort of the Trump of it all?
Definitely Lottie Beth Hobbs became a bigger character representing the evangelicals, and Rosemary Thompson as a you know, pretty far right believer. Those two roles were expanded quite a bit. We also found, you know, originally I thought episode 2 would encompass all the way through the convention and not be split into what became Gloria and Shirley. And after I wrote a draft, and it was just, there was too much story to fit into one episode. And that's when I split it up into focusing on Glory and her fight for abortion rights, and then picking up that story, but through Shirley's point of view in the third episode. So that also added an episode. Okay. I'm very happy we took our time with both of those.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I can't imagine this season.
I know. Yes. I don't know what I was thinking.
I can't imagine it less than 9, and actually I want more than 9, so yeah.
I love that.
one of my favorite conversations that I've had with your talented cast this season is with Margot Martindale, who got actually kind of emotional talking about how...
Oh my God, I haven't listened to it yet. I'm so very excited to listen to it, but tell me.
Well, she got... Yeah, she got kind of emotional talking about how, you know, she wasn't a feminist, you know, during this time, the time that this movement was happening. And I asked her sort of like, okay, well, when did you start to feel like one? And she said, making this show. And she kind of like broke down about it. And she was just like, it really changed me. And like, I feel, you know, and she's like, I'll be out there this time. I'll be fighting, like all this sort of stuff. And so I was just curious, you know, how you feel like this show has changed you. You don't have to get as emotional as Margo Martindale did, but you can if you want to.
Well, I don't want to be a clip by Margo Martindale. I can't cry as Margo ever. I think similarly, it has galvanized me. I definitely was guilty of living in a bubble before 2016 and believing that we are in a post-feminist world and things were relatively equal, even if not exactly. And I think I've definitely been awakened to the deep iniquities and the systemic sexism and misogyny that still plagues us, and feel very galvanized having gone through this to fight for equality. And that it, you know, no one wants to be fighting all the time. Everyone just wants to relax. But I really came away feeling like it's so dangerous to be complacent. And the flip side is that I also came away from this experience feeling like we have to listen to people we don't agree with. You know, that living in an echo chamber doesn't really change anything. Tweeting to people, if your followers will all agree with you and heart what you're saying, doesn't really make anything change or different. You really have to find some way to... We have to interact with people we don't agree with if we're going to get anything done. I mean, not that I personally can get anything done, but I think just being open to that conversation, even when it's uncomfortable and hard, is probably important. Yeah. I also came away from this experience wanting to do many more shows with lots of amazing female characters.
Yeah, like,
I'd worked on so many shows. I mean, in my, you have to look at my CV, and I've worked on so many shows that are focused on men, and I, there's just such a joy in that bonding that Margo talked about with her, like as a past. I mean, I think when you get to be in a show with so many other powerful, amazing actresses playing also complicated roles and to be in scenes with them. So I'd love to be writing more of that. That was my other takeaway and what I got out of it.
Have you had any ideas about another very female centric?
Oh my gosh. So many, but none I can really speak to that's set up anywhere. But they're in doing this show and looking around and being suddenly aware of like how many shows I watch that are centered on men, there is still a scarcity of great programs and roles for women in it. And I hope we see more. And there's so many untold stories from history, even from this time period, that I didn't even get to fit into this show that could be told. So I think it's exciting, and I hope that we just start seeing more of these stories told.
I want the like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead version of Mrs. America season one. Season two is just like all the other women who are involved.
Oh my god! Tom Stoppard is my idol, so I love that you mentioned that. Well, one of my editors, Todd, who edited the Houston episode, he used to joke, he's like, if you do a spinoff, it's got to be Rosemary Thompson and Betty Friedan, the odd couple, get an apartment in the city together. I was like, sold. Done. Melanie and Tracy, I'm there. I'm here for it.
I love that.
So that's one idea on the table.
I'm for it. We're
open to others. Golly.
Just call it like Betty and Rosemary. Oh my god, I would watch it in heart.
Right?
Or like maybe even like a, I mean, we could get a foursome going, right? We could do like a Golden Girls style foursome.
Oh my god, Golden Girls. I mean, I could also watch it. I could also do Bella and Betty any day of the week. I mean, we had one scene with the two of them together and in the Bella episode, and it was such a blast. Those two together.
Good. They were so great.
Oh, great.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the show, for talking.
Oh, thanks, Joanna.
I appreciate it. So, Richard, is Too Little Feminists, are we, is that stuck in your head at all right now, fresh off the finale?
I mean, stuck in my head, sure, but also it made me think about the I think it's the pilot episode of Studio 60 and the Sunset Strip, the doomed Aaron Sorkin show, about a late night comedy show where the big, like, they have a final sketch problem. Or no, it's an opening number problem or something, opening sketch problem. And then the genius writer decides, actually, and Sarah Paulson's in that show.
She is.
Decides to, it says, oh, I got it. You know, this is like 2006 or something. A Gilbert and Sullivan parody. And it's like, that wouldn't have saved anything in 2006. But, you know, so here we have other worse dorks using the same source material.
Yeah, I have to say the dorkiness of, like, Phyllis backstage, like, singing along to the words that she probably helped write and, like, so self-satisfied with it. And it is so corny and hokey, and everyone's laughing so hard. I mean, it's fantastic. There was also,
well, conservatives can't do comedy. They're not funny.
There's also a cutaway to, John playing the piano for them during the lyric when they're talking about, like the gay exclusion from the ERA movement and stuff like that, which is like our last kind of check in with John, there.
They even do the limp wrist when they say gay.
Yep, they sure do. I want to, so it's like Phyllis then gives a speech and this directly addresses, I don't know if you saw any of the interviews that, Anne Schlafly Corey, Phyllis's daughter gave. She gave a lot of interviews before the show came out about how much it maligned her mother. And, you can take those all, including one to, Vanity Fair. And you can take all of those with a, you know, a mountain of salt if you want to. And one of her main critiques was that the show, you know, really got wrong about Phyllis was that, you know, her children were her focus. And here's a quote from an interview she gave our colleague, Julie Miller. I know what really motivated Phyllis Schlafly, her family. What did she say was her greatest achievement? Her six children. Here in this episode, we have, like, this episode was written before and gave those interviews, written and filmed and printed. And, they have Phyllis saying exactly that. And just because you say that doesn't mean, you know, that's true. It rings so false, when she says it. What did you think of that speech and that moment where she's directly addressing her family?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's true to some extent, but, in practice, I think that part of things gets at a really interesting, kind of vexing issue, when it comes to issues of motherhood and working women and all these things where the question of, like, where in the kind of priority schema should children, if they factor in at all, factor in, right? And should we celebrate a certain brand of, you know, let alone the men who don't really, you know, everyone just says, oh, he held a baby once. Congratulations. He's the best father. Whereas with women, it's like, right, there's oftentimes with wealthy, powerful women, not an acknowledgement of nannies and other domestic help, you know, things like that. And I think in this moment at the banquet, like, you see her completely pretend or gloss over the fact that her sister-in-law has helped her through this whole thing, in terms of raising children. And is not acknowledged for that. At the same time, should we say that, like, she should have put children, you know, motherhood first above all else. And, you know, that should have been the sort of, you know, her greatest, you know, mission and sacrifice in life. No, not that either. The problem is from the Phyllis side of things, compared to the left, the progressive view on these things is the progressive side is willing to talk about the complications of that, you know, and to acknowledge that not one situation does not apply to all, that everyone's home life is different, everyone's priorities are different, and to try to make the best policy that can help everyone, as many people as possible, at least. Whereas Phyllis kind of wants to prescribe one way of doing things and then live a different reality for herself, which is where you start to see the cliche, the hypocrisy really kind of come out of her argument in this episode, and then see a little bit of the collapse of it in some senses.
Yeah, you know, do we expect her to acknowledge the family cook, Willie Reed in this speech? No, though she should. But the face-to-face slighting of Eleanor is just, like, especially Jean Triplehorn's little face, as it's happening. Once again, it goes back to these, like, very personal, attacks that Phyllis makes, throughout this series that hit even harder for me than some of her wide scale damage that she does. And I, you know, maybe that's reverse priorities, but I do like, you know, Davi talked about in the interview you guys just heard. I do like the little like invented moment they have for Eleanor here where she gets to meet a man. Not that, you know, that's the end all be all of everything, but like gets to embark on an adventure of her own, it seems, outside this event, and is absent from the question later in the episode when, like, they Anne is missing, she didn't get a ride back from school, who's gonna pick her up? Like, Eleanor isn't in that conversation because she's off having her own adventure, which you would wish for her. So, I like that.
Yeah, and in that scene, you start to see the tenuous arrangement of Phyllis's life start to crumble, where her husband is like, you can tell, kind of like, well, all right, this has gone as far as it needs to it can go. You need to like snap back and return to your duties, you know. And when there is such an unyielding idea of parental responsibility, household responsibility, it's gonna swing back and hit her in Phyllis in the face, which, you know, it doesn't exactly in this episode, but you get the sense of how, in a broader sense, for more people who kind of espouse this thing, it can and probably does, you know. When push comes to shove, you have to kind of practice what you preach, and in her case, it's, you know, duty to home first.
Yeah, I mean, we will get to the ending, and I have a lot of thoughts on that final image, but yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And like the image from this event, with Phyllis in that designer gown, which is a real gown that Phyllis wore at a later event, but they like found it online, and it's this like really striking thing that is, of course, on all the promotional material for Mrs. America with like the winged, sleeves and stuff like that. This just like this. It's a beautiful dress, and it's also a preposterous dress, and it's just all part of like this whole theater of Phyllis Schlafly. You know what I mean? This whole, like, her whole speech is just sort of like, I say these things because I know it makes the libbers angry, and like all this sort of stuff like that, which is something she actually said. You know, it's just like, she's such a ridiculous woman, and maddening, enraging to watch, which is why Alice sort of drunkenly losing her shit on her is really cathartic for us to watch in this episode, you know?
Yeah. And I think what it also shows, I mean, you know, one of the empathetic things about this show is that it shows that Phyllis and her compatriots or whatever are caught in the same trap, you know,
right,
in the same, like, dress up and look pretty, but also then maybe they'll just think of you as kind of a Barbie doll. But then if you don't, then they'll dismiss you. And so they are trying to play by the same, by the rules imposed on all women, they see a different course through that, and it's one that I think you and I both disagree with, and I think the show ultimately does as well, obviously. But you can't not see the binding they're placed in, you know, and not feel some, you know, sympathy and I guess pity in a sense. I mean, pity sounds like a condescending word, but like, you know, they're not in a good situation either, and that's not really of their own doing, even if they are in some senses fighting to uphold that system.
Yeah, so that's a perfect segue into this Gloria Steinem interview. So Gloria Steinem gave this interview to The Guardian on May 22nd, or at least it was published on May 22nd, which was unfortunately after I spoke to all of our guests for this podcast, so I could not ask them directly about that. Though you'll hear from Stacey Scherr sort of addressing some of the stuff that Gloria talked about, even unprompted. So we'll get to that in a second. But I, you know, rather than read from the emails we got from folks asking us to talk about this interview, I thought I would read a bit from the interview itself. Gloria, not a fan of the show, but also not convinced she's watched the show. So here's what Gloria said. What is important to remember, though, women may be a problem for other women. They don't have the power to be the big problem. Women may be adversaries, but we don't have the power to be our own worst adversaries. For instance, there's now a not very good series here called Mrs. America, and it gives you the impression that Schlafly, who was a very religious and right-wing woman who opposed the Equal Rights Amendment, it gives you the impression that she was the reason it was defeated. In actuality, I don't believe she changed one vote. Nobody could ever discover that she changed even one vote. The insurance industry here opposed the Equal Rights Amendment because if they stopped segregating their actuarial tables, it would cost them millions upon millions of dollars. Schlafly was someone brought in at the last minute to make it seem that women opposed equal rights when the truth was the vast majority already supported it, Steinem said. And this is the last quote from Steinem. The series makes it seem as if women are our own worst enemies, which keeps us from recognizing who our worst enemies are. Not that we aren't in conflict. Yes, we are in conflict. But by and large, we don't have the power to be our own worst enemies. And before Richard, I get your reaction to that, I do want to throw to our interview with Stacey Scher, where she brought up the insurance issue herself. So here we go. Here is Stacey Scher. How did this idea come to you in the first place?
I had watched a documentary that was on PBS that was made by Makers, and it was about second wave feminism, and there were all different pieces to it. And one segment of it was about Phyllis Schlafly. And that this idea, I kind of remembered her, but quite honestly, couldn't really tell the difference between her as a cultural fixture, you know, between her and Anita Bryant.
Right.
And one of the things that people said when they were talking about her, aside from also talking about the fact that she was definitely working with the insurance lobbies because her main interest was defense. But and she didn't really care about the ERA when she first started out. But they talked about the hypocritical nature of her making a name for herself as a woman who essentially lived her life as a liberated woman, preaching the joy of staying at home when she really wasn't.
Can you talk a little bit about the insurance lobby angle?
Well, you know, the insurance lobbies, actually up until the Affordable Care Act, were able to essentially treat being a woman as a pre-existing condition so that you can charge women more. And there have been a lot of things that are, so life insurance, health insurance, you know, many things, you were allowed to discriminate what you charged men and women for their premiums, and auto insurance. And so, and essentially that was the rule in the same way that people talked extensively about the pink tax, where there's, you know, let's talk about like razors for men versus razors for women.
Right.
And women's razors cost more than men's razors. They're pink. Mm-hmm. So that was that was referred to as the pink tax. And then of course, there are laws still in many places where, necessities like sanitary goods are still taxed and in ways that condoms are not.
Right.
So the insurance lobby stood to lose a tremendous amount of money by changing these rules. And that's frankly, you know, other ways in which they've worked against the Affordable Care Act. I kind of intuitively felt that if we told the story of second wave feminism from the point of view of the feminists, we'd be backing ourselves into a hagiography.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought if you inverted the storytelling and started with the point of view of the spoiler, that it gave you the opportunity to humanize these figures who I hugely admire and whose shoulders we all stand on.
Why, in your view, was Davi the person to help tell that story?
Davi and I had worked on two projects before we began working on this together. I loved working with her. She's one of the smartest. She's just this kind of extraordinary combination of a really gifted and entertaining and deep, you know, and I knew that both of those things were going to be required to make people want to stay with these characters week after week and learn something that could be viewed by some people as wonky.
You have a long history in Hollywood. You've worked on some of my very favorite projects, such as the TV show Sweet Vicious, one of my favorite things that has ever existed. You know, was the road to getting this project made any easier or more difficult than getting your other projects made? And if so, you know, sort of what helped you, what hindered you?
I think my blessing or curse is, you know, that I'm relentless, you know, and sometimes I can look down the resume and go, hey, maybe I should have let that go. But we had great partners in John Landgraf and FX. And, you know, who would buy this idea anyway? And who, when Hillary Clinton didn't get elected,
right,
stuck with us when we had to really reconceive the show? And it went from being something that was going to be a bit shorter, like 6 episodes, and really became an origin story for the culture wars that we're in now, to explain how we got here from there, you know, when Trump was elected. You know, that in itself was a feat.
I'm wondering, you know, if you had any concerns going into the project or in launching the project, if you had any concerns about what the reaction would be like, and if you had any concerns, how has the reaction either surprised you or confirmed anything you were worried about?
I think that what surprised me is that sometimes people are looking for in episode 1 for somebody to lay all their cards on the table. And again, we knew that we were playing a long game of getting to where we end up here, you know, in episode 9, which everyone will see, that you couldn't start out, depending on which side of the spectrum you fall on, whether, you know, whether you're a staunch conservative or extremely liberal, you can't start out demonizing or canonizing. You have to start out kind of neutral so that you have somewhere to go dramatically. So I think that surprised me, that people didn't understand that we were telling a story. I think right. that people are far, I don't know about you. I don't know what you think about this, but I think that people are far more, and Davi and I talked about it in the development process, far more accepting of male anti-heroes or male, you know, birth of an antagonist kind of origin stories than they are with women.
Oh, absolutely. Of course. You know, I think some of a lot of the concern around this idea of are we treating Phyllis Schlafly as the monster, you know, that so many people view her as, you know, or are we treating her with two soft kid gloves? You know, some of that is based on that thinking, but I think plenty of it is that discomfort in watching a woman in this role that is practically worn out for men at this point with the amount of TV antiheroes that we've seen.
I think that who does history remember? Yes, we're telling the story and people are now going to know who Phyllis Schlafly was, that we're outside of, you know, a niche of politics, and really not such a niche, a large part of where we live in our political spectrum right now. However, you can't hold progress back. You can hold it back for a while, but all the things that she used as incendiary items to terrify people, gay marriage, same-sex bathrooms, if you take the natural extension of this small national government, you know, we're living in Phyllis Schlafly's America now. So, and you see the botched response to the pandemic, we're living with their idea of, you know, taking away the size of the federal government and how it protects us. Started out, we were on the precipice of something historic and thinking that we were going to rise above our internalized patriarchal biases in this country.
Yeah.
And it turned out that we really weren't. And, you know, off the record, just for the conversation. Uh-huh. But I think the thing that happened all on its own was that the parallels were catching up with the show. Like, a woman's right to choose became a really significant issue again. Redistricting, you could turn on, you know, the New York Times Daily podcast and hear an entire episode on redistricting. Every single issue that was going on in the culture wars and raging in 1972, probably in reaction to the forward momentum of the civil rights movement. You know, they push back against the women's movement. So I think that, you know, certainly maybe that was also the case with suffrage after the abolition of slavery. But we definitely were hoping that while Phyllis was hoist on her own petard, certainly, and never got what she wanted because she was too polarizing. So we also look at the fact that what happens to women when they try to achieve power in a way that's viewed as unacceptable, that it, we also hope that it reminds people that, you know, what the power of activism is, and you got to get out there, and that ultimately if you keep pushing forward and you don't go to sleep, you can affect change.
On that note, I was at the Television Critics Association press tour when, you know, one of my colleagues asked you all about, you know, your daughters and watching the show, and you and Elizabeth Banks made a really good point about like, okay, but ask us about our sons and watching this show. So I was wondering if you talk about, you know, either both your kids, if you care to, and, you know, maybe specifically your son and his experience being on set or watching the show, and what questions he has and how this might help shape a future generation of young men and their view of women.
Well, I will say that my 18-year-old son loves the show. and my kids are brutally honest with me about anything I do. You know, he cares a lot about social justice issues. And so I think what the show really does is look at feminism in the context of social justice issues. And I think that it really looks at the origin story of how feminism became the other F word.
Right.
And I think showing these women as not, the strident shrews that the media has, you know, portrayed them as, you know, liberal and right wing alike, you know, I mean, has been really enlightening for my son, you know, to look at what a simple concept feminism is and what a simple concept the equal rights. With regards to the Equal Rights Amendment, I think both my kids thought that it was something that was already in the Constitution before I started working on the show.
Right. It seems weird to hope because it's been sort of so many years of what feels like hopelessness. But honestly, you know, this show, the moments of beautiful hope that are captured in this show, you know, that a number of the women who worked on it have talked about, and including those convention scenes, you know, this is a good time for this show. It makes me want to fight really hard this year, this election year. So thank you for
I'm glad that you felt that way at the end of episode 9, because that's really what my hope was, that people walked away saying that democracy and justice are worth fighting for. Look, I will say that the thing that was surprising is everybody wants to give Phyllis short shrift for her organizing skills, you know? And my daughter and I were talking to my mom during Mother's Day, and my mom briefly was a teacher, and she was talking about how, yeah, it was one of the few careers that women were encouraged to pursue because they got the summer off to be with their kids and they could be home after school with their kids. Mm. And she said, and that's why historically teachers are paid so little money, because it was a woman's job.
God.
I mean, so when we think about why do we pay teachers so little money? Because it was married women who were viewed as it being supplemental income who chose to work.
Wow.
That's crazy when you start to unpack the layers of the kind of internalized patriarchal bias.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine that's also true the nursing profession. Like stereotypical female professions.
You know, what is that expression? Every generation has to earn back their, you know, relitigate their rights again. And I think that we're really seeing it now. You know, I think we thought the backlash was over yes, there was a backlash to the women's movement, but there's so much other progress. Nobody really was looking at the way that those guys were putting together their team and starting to stack judges and starting all of that, you know.
All right, so Richard, do you have any thoughts on sort of what Gloria Steinem has to say here and how this episode may or may not directly address that?
I mean, I think she makes an 100% valid point, both about the show and about the larger argument about someone like Schlafly, which is, and look, we see it now where the powers that be benefit from infighting, you know,
right.
They benefit from the left going after the left. I'm not saying that that doesn't mean there shouldn't be conflict, as, you know, Steinem doesn't say that either, within, you know, within the ranks. But I think that, you know, I don't know how much of the show she's watched. Maybe the whole thing, maybe none of it, maybe some of it. I don't know. But like for me, from my personal perspective on the show, which isn't really in disagreement with what Steinem said, but, is that for me, and maybe it's a failing of the series' kind of construction, maybe not. I don't really think this show's about the ERA. You know, I think it's about a fault line on ideological grounds that really started to widen in the '70s, and that's why the series ends where it does. And yes, the ERA is the kind of through line that takes us through the series, and maybe there were demagoguery from people like Schlafly that was changing minds on the vote. Maybe it was just insurance agencies. Maybe it was some kind of combination of the two things. I certainly wouldn't doubt if behind closed doors, the men of big business were just, you know, never going to see this thing through to begin with, you know? But I think that what I found so enriching about the show was not necessarily the granular history about the ERA itself, but more a snapshot and snapshot sounds small, but a pretty wide reaching survey, let's say, of a moment in time and a kind of shifting political understanding of this country. I think that the show succeeds on that merits really well. Whether or not it gets at the root of the specific mechanics of the ERA's passage or not passage. And I don't know, but, I feel like, you know, Steinem is well within her rights and then some to weigh in on the show. And it's a really interesting interview people should read.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because I think especially this episode, and not that I would tell Gloria Steinem, just wait till you see the finale, but like I really feel like the finale drives home this whole we have the same enemy, which is something that I think the show has danced around here and there, you know what I mean? Like, the Jill episode where Jill talks to Phyllis and she's like, you know, they're looking up your skirt, Phyllis, like all this sort of stuff like that. Like, we are on the same team and the team we're on is to try to break through the ways in which the patriarchy has put a cap on our potential. And the way in which the men in this episode, and we'll get to Carter and Reagan, push down women on both sides of the aisle. I think, you know, in calling this episode Reagan, like Davi was sort of joking about it, but like, in our interview, but like, you know, this is the first episode named for a man. And I think the idea that here in the finale, we are seeing the ways in which the men are really the ones wielding the hammer, really, really shines through, I think.
And have been presiding over it the whole time.
Right. Allowing women this thing, yeah, and that thing sort of thing.
And then not, you know, and I think that, you know, something this makes me think about from my own little side of things is, within like the gay rights movement. I think we mentioned a few weeks ago that, like, you know, when you learn gay history, you learn about the men of Stonewall, some trans women, but like that's kind of only recently been included in the historical record about the, you know, that, you know, incident. You don't really, at least institutionally, read a lot about women, queer women who were involved in all of this stuff from the '60s on. And you look at what happened with gay marriage, where a lot of wealthy white gay men, you know, worked very hard, seemingly in league with, other progressive causes, to get that, to become, you know, nationwide law that, you know, that gay marriage was legal. And then, I don't know, just anecdotally, I've seen a lot of those rich white gay men or not so rich white gay men, turn pretty fucking conservative all of a sudden. you know, and because they got what they wanted and they're still men at the end of the day. And, you know, then women and, you know, non-binary people and whoever else gets shut out of the conversation because this is still a world ordered by men. And I think you're right that the show, this episode, not in any sort of like overbearing bonk you on the head way, you know, reminds you, especially in the stuff with Bella and the Carter administration, that like, this was still, you know, for all of the kind of intro woman stuff happening throughout the series, like there was a bigger Leviathan that they and we all have to contend with.
Yeah, so I agree with you. And I think Stacey did a better job than I could of explaining sort of the connection, why the insurance agencies would be invested literally in stopping the ERA. But I will say it's my belief that Davi Waller and Stacey Scherr and a lot of other people who made the show did believe that there was powerful men backing Phyllis Schlafly. But I think something that Davi was very, 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 very careful to do, and this comes through in all the times that I've been like, well, this actually happened, is not show us anything that she couldn't like prove in a newspaper clipping or something like that. And if there is no smoking gun paper trail connecting Phyllis Schlafly to investors from the insurance industry, men working behind her, then I think this show is not the show that wanted to say, well, probably X, and make it seem like it's fact, you know? Not the least of which because the Eagle Forum seems like a really litigious organization, but also I just think that, you know, that was the commitment that the show made. And so, you know, Stacey Scherr wrote an op-ed for Variety that you can read about the series and some of the things that they thought about, but I think that they did not want to, I think the closest that they got is in the first episode. Clem Stone, who was an insurance billionaire, was one of Schlafly's political backers, and that is raised in the first episode. But unless you know who that is, you're not really going to make that connection for yourself. So I understand sort of Steinem's perspective on that. But I think, you know, if they had their druthers, that connection is something that they would have underlined more, you know, if this were a different kind of show. Does that make sense? So, for better or for worse, that's the show that we have here. And so that brings us to one of the, a big male antagonist of this episode, who's Hamilton Jordan, who's a figure I knew nothing about, but this is, one of Carter's guys, right? And, chief aide to Carter. And basically when Jimmy Carter was elected, he brought a bunch of, guys from Georgia with him, including this guy, Hamilton Jordan. They were called, the Georgia Mafia by some members of the Washington media. Cause basically, like, I think, I didn't fact check this, but I think Clinton did something similar with some of his Arkansas guys. And, this idea of, you know, regional political people who don't have experience in Washington not blending in well, with the Washington political machine. That was sort of this idea with the Georgia Mafia that came with Jimmy Carter. They were described as cocky guys by, some of the reporters at the time. And apparently there's this anecdote that Hamilton Jordan has denied in his own autobiography, but there is an anecdote where, like he was caught with cocaine. I think he was caught, allegedly caught with cocaine at Studio 54. I don't care if you do cocaine at Studio 54. Everyone was doing cocaine at Studio 54. Who cares? But another sort of, story about him was that, he stared at the breasts of the Egyptian ambassador's wife at a Washington reception and remarked, "I've always wanted to see the pyramids." So, this is the kind of, guy we are allegedly dealing with. He also wrote a memo to Carter in 79, telling him to, fire his entire cabinet. The memo, you can find the memo online. The bullet point number four is you'll feel good after you do it. And Carter went ahead and did it. So like, you know, they're not overblowing this guy's, scumminess or his influence, on Carter. And I think as portrayed by a Canadian actor, Dan Byrne, doing a really nice Georgia drawl to my ears. I think this slimy dude is a really, really good representative of, you know, some of the guys that stand in our way in life. Richard, did this land at all for you?
I mean, I had traumatic flashbacks to a freshman year roommate in college who was this guy.
Yeah. This guy is so familiar.
Just kind of weaselly and like nominally on your side, quote unquote, but like not really. And more sort of concerned with the, exercising of might and power and access and, you know, than anything else. I mean, I think it's never more evident than it is right now that people, quote unquote, on the right side of things, on the good side of things, our men in particular are, you know, just as bigoted as everything they accuse the other side of being, you know, just in different ways and sometimes more insidious ways, because to say everything bad that you can about the other side, at least they're more honest about it. At least they're more direct about it. You know, I don't know. It's not really a credit to them, but it makes them a little bit easier to fight, in some ways. But, I just think that it's a skin crawly couple scenes with that guy because he is so recognizable.
And that's the thing, is he's not, I mean, honestly, to have a scene where he made that awful pyramid joke, almost would have, I think, undermined the like more subtle villainy of this character, who's just like smiling and while being just the complete worst. All this stuff happened. 22 members of the National Advisory Committee on Women resigned in protest. This did happen, like the whole meeting in the morning and then them already deciding to fire her. All of that happened exactly sort of as the show lays it out. This is why I brought up last week that the character of Carmen Delgado Vota should have been probably seated a little earlier in the series, because she seems like so important in this moment of resignation, which is so cool. But yeah, they like tried to give the job to her and she said no, and all these other women resigned. It's a really cool moment. Once again, it's just a character that I wish we had seen earlier. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I also think that with like the whole Bella storyline in this episode, I mean, separate of the machinations of the Carter administration, is I like that scene at the end when she's with her husband and, you know, he's like, well, what do we do now? What's the next step? And she's like, well, we could, you know, encourage our kids to have children so we could have grandkids, or we could go to the Amalfi Coast or whatever. Earlier, I forget what the order is, but you see Betty Friedan, who is, you know, doing some kind of bogus charity women's, you know, ERA run in the Hamptons with Paul Newman and Carl Reiner and Lucy Arnaz, as she calls her. And I like that the show, which with those characters in particular, we've seen them grapple with the fading of their own legacy as they see it, or a kind of creeping obsolescence, you know, like that a younger generation is moving past them and stopping listening to them. I like that the show has both grappled with those concerns, and also in a way not putting them out to pasture at all, but giving anyone who is that tireless an advocate for a righteous political cause the sort of permission, the allowance to just like take a breather and to maybe like not retire 100 exactly, but like just, it's okay to sit a little bit in your own life after all that work you've done. Like, I think it's nice that it wasn't kind of forcing anyone into on and on and on into a tireless campaign. Like, I like that they let Bella in particular, breathe a little bit. I thought that was really sweet.
Yeah. And there's a similar moment. You know, she has that phone call with Shirley, and there's a similar moment for Shirley Chisholm where she's, you know, she gets reelected, but she's like, I don't think I'm going to run again. And just sort of like, there's no real space for us here. And just, but that doesn't negate that the work they've done leading up to that. You know what I mean? So, the one thing I did want to mention about, the advisory panel on women before we roll on is I was curious, the show doesn't address this, but I was curious sort of like, okay, was that it? Like when those 22 women resigned, did the panel go away? Like what happened here? And I found out that they gave the appointment, to Linda Bird Johnson Robb, who's, one of LBJ's daughters, right? And, she seems, you know, she's a Democrat. She seems like a very nice woman. She like has done a lot of great work around literacy and stuff like that. But here is how the profile, on her, the, you know, the news that she was taking over the panel, opens with this sentence. She has been the perfect political daughter, the perfect political wife, raising neither conflicts nor controversy. That's the first sentence of the New York Times article on Linda Bird Johnson Robb taking over Bella Abzug's position. And you're just sort of like, right. They found someone who would be quiet and nice. And not that it much mattered because Carter would be out of the White House imminently anyway. But, that, you know, to, like, I was thinking about, I was like, that's like replacing, like, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with, like, Jenna Bush or something. Like, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's a real slap in the face for the work of these women. Which is not, you know, it's not really a knock on, Johnson Robb because she seems, you know, like a nice person. It's just a quiet person. And that was the whole thing is that these women were too loud and too demanding. The New York Times, article about, Bella's firing, says, someone from the White House said, there should be no need for the White House to cringe in advance of a meeting with a committee set up to provide advice and assistance. So basically they were too loud, too pushy for this position and were replaced. So there you go. So that brings us to the end, which I want to focus on, what happens to Phyllis here. You know, you will have heard Davi Waller earlier in the episode talk about this ending for Phyllis and why it was important. I think Davi and Stacey both talked about this, why it was important to show Phyllis in a place of defeat, even in victory, for sort of the tone that they wanted to set for the show. And Davi's point was, it seemed right to her that even that men would find a way to push Phyllis down, even if she got them the White House. If we want to say that that's, you know, that's something that Phyllis actually did, accomplish. She's also shut out. She's erased from the Goldwater memoir. So what do you think, Richard? Does this feel like a suitably, bitter, I'm not even going to call it bittersweet, just bitter ending for Phyllis Schlafly in this series?
I think it's suitably complicated. And I mean complicated in terms of how we in the audience are prone to react to it, you know, because on the one hand, in just the immediate interiority of the dramatic plot, it's sad that the person we're watching doesn't get the thing that they want, you know. And it's more frustrating with a little more context added onto it that she doesn't get it because of backroom conversations between men about the best way to, you know, get the lady vote, I guess. And so, yeah, like through in just that little kind of contained space, you feel for her, because she did, you know, it wasn't work that I support, but she did work really hard, to wrestle this reality into existence and then was completely shut out of it. But of course, then that's where the complex thing comes in, because then it's like, well, but fuck all that. I mean, like, she's the worst. Everything is the worst. Like, isn't she getting what she deserves? Shows her, like, she should have known that, that, you know, none of the men she was tirelessly working to prop up were actually gave a shit about her or her cause or anything. They were just using her as a political tool, and they were just wanted to get her, you know,
her mailing list
off
yeah.
her floppy disks, and that was it. And she has been just as kind of used and tossed aside as Pamela is, as anybody is, any woman we've seen on this show. And yeah, so I think, you know, I think to end on that note of ambivalence, you know, feeling something somewhat strongly on either side of it, is the right tack for this show to take. I mean, it's not 100% satisfying. You wish there could be some come to Jesus moment for Phyllis, or someone would really tell her off in a way that Alice started to before, again, the rest of the world intervened and they all had to evacuate the building. But, you know, there's no closure to this story. So I think that ending on a note of defeat, but also persistence, pity, but also revulsion, is exactly the right way to say goodbye to this version of Phyllis Schlafly.
Yeah, it's the idea that, like, both Bella and Phyllis are, like, too divisive to be allowed into the Halls of Power. You know what I mean? Is a really fascinating parallel that, like, once again, like, the show doesn't have to invent. It's just there. It's just all happened in 1979, 1980. It all happened at the same time. It's true for all women at that time and now. You know what I mean? Just coming off of this presidential primary. And watching, like, every single woman, female candidate, you know, be described as unlikable. Like, it's still here. You know what I mean? It's not gone anywhere. And so I think you're right. I think this story isn't over because I think the ending, especially with, like, you know, the archive and contemporary footage that's used at the end of this episode, is meant to galvanize us to keep fighting, to fight more, to use this as an example of you know, what we should not assume is done or assume can't be taken from us, you know. So I want to talk about, like, the literal final moments, right? Because, Phyllis gets this bad news. Her husband comes in and once again, I do appreciate the sort of, like, weird line that they walk with the Schlafly marriage and stuff like that. And so, like, he is supportive. He's like, you were robbed. And I believe that he would genuinely say that to her, but also, should we have some dinner? Which he doesn't
really fuss him that much.
Yeah, and it also he's not saying, like, get in the kitchen and make me dinner, woman, but he is just saying, like, this will make us feel better. Let's have some dinner that you will go make right now in our kitchen. And so, like, you know, we'll go to Kate Blanchett in a second, but Kate Blanchett like sort of called it back to the kitchen moment for Phyllis, right? She's inescapably where she was trying to escape from. And she mentioned the film Jean Dimon by Chantal Ackerman. This is a sort of a very famous feminist film from the 70s that ends like where, you know, it shows the, you know, this woman doing sort of this quotidian everyday stuff that involves sex work as well as sort of domesticity. And she murders one of her Johns right at the end of the film. She kills him in this sort of moment of, like, feminist uprising or whatever. And then ends the film sitting. I mean, I think the framing of Phyllis sitting at the kitchen table is meant as an exact homage to that film. Where the protagonist is sitting at the dining room table just at the end, silently, the camera's on her. That film was actually, I almost mentioned it last week and I didn't, but it's actually playing in the background, at one point as Alice is wandering around the Houston Convention Center. Along with the music, which is the song Little Weaver Bird by Molly Drake, Nick Drake's mom, which is this weird little curiosity of an album of songs that Molly Drake composed and sang in the 50s. So this idea of, like, back in the 50s, back in the kitchen, that is where Phyllis winds up after all of her hard work. There's nothing wrong with being in the kitchen. I like cooking in the kitchen. Like, let us not be misunderstood. We're not saying being in the kitchen is inherently wrong, but being restricted to the kitchen is what feels inherently wrong for a lot of women. And that's sort of where we see Phyllis put in her place. So I think it's a very fitting, not without its sympathies, but also just sort of like this is a defeat. This is a moment of defeat, you know? So
One thing about the scene where she's, you know, in the kitchen paring the apples.
Yeah.
That I did realize that we have at least improved some on in the last 40 years is that now when we're all stuck in our kitchens making food, we can listen to podcasts. Because she's sitting there in silence. Maybe she could have turned on the radio. But,
she could listen to Still Watching, man.
Yeah. No, I'm joking. But I mean, again, I think it's a complicated, tricky sort of thing. It is necessarily a lot of sentiments at once jumbled into one scene. And I think that there is a read of it that's a little reductive, maybe that like that there's a read of it that says that the show, the ending of the show is a little reductive, like the literalness of the kitchen and all that. But, I think that there's a little bit more happening in the scene than that read would suggest. And then to kind of follow up with, you know, archival footage of the real women involved in the show and, you know, these kind of title cards explaining, what, you know, sort of progress or lack thereof has been made, helps really ground it in the real world, in a way that I found pretty moving.
So let us hear from, Kate Blanchett herself about, this whole season and specifically that ending for Phyllis. Well, let's do it. This is it. We've come to the end of the road.
Look, I know. It wasn't until I was told I was speaking to you about the last episode. I went, what? How did that happen?
How did we get here? Well, I wanted to start by asking a question that I asked both Stacey and Davi, which is this show could have ended with this sort of a victory for Phyllis. But it ends in a kind of a very real personal defeat for her. I'm wondering how important you feel like it was to show her in defeat, in this final episode.
History is always written by the victors, isn't it? And the victors are always very public about those victories. And the interesting thing I think about Phyllis's legacy is that her influence and achievements, dubious achievements, were absorbed by the men around her. And so in that way, even though she would never acknowledge this and didn't ever acknowledge it, and she didn't ever proclaim that she had any disappointment in her life whatsoever, when one delves behind the public face of who people say they are, we're all human. And I think it was really important to show all the women that way, Phyllis included. And that what happened, whether Phyllis acknowledges or not, is that she wasn't successful in any of her runs for Congress, nor, given that she was a political animal, was she ever successful in getting into the corridors of power. And I think that that was something that we felt that was really important to, I suppose, a really important connected line to form between all of the women, no matter what side of politics they fell on. So even though, in fact, she won the battle, she lost the war. I think that was a really a great place and a provocative place to leave an audience, because then they go back and see the changes that were wrought by Phyllis and her supporters, even though the ERA was never ratified, and those things that weren't achieved by the feminists, and the things that were achieved, even though the ERA wasn't ratified. So in fact, look, they fell very much. The experience of the women, no matter what side of politics they fell on, was kind of similar. And I think the melancholic place that the women were left in, and the compromises that they had to make, there's a lot of similarities, I think. And that was something I think that we were striving to represent.
I know we spoke when we talked about the first episode, we spoke a bit about how the making of the show changed your view or informed your view on certain things. But I'm wondering, now that we're headed towards the end of sharing this thing you've made with the world, how does the reception of the show, or has it in any way changed your perception of either the work itself or the era?
What has been rewarding, I think, is how engaged people seem by the story, and not not necessarily from a political perspective, but on a human level. Because in the end, it was about trying to find the points of intersection as well as pointing out the monumental differences between those who fell on both sides of the what was such a caustic, toxic war over something so obvious and I would have hoped be banal in a way, is the quality. And so I've been really buoyed up by how engaged people are, but also there's a bit of sweet quality to embracing that reaction, because it does mean that people need to be told this story still. You know, and so you think, well, what? There's a lot that hasn't moved for people, you know, and that is certainly something. Watching this series inside the pandemic, is the pandemic has revealed monumental inequalities that are still trenchant inequalities that still exist, not only between sexes, but between the haves and have-nots, between citizens and immigrants and refugees. You know, it's and but I still think that the how relevant this story is ultimately. It's that makes me feel quite melancholy, I guess. Yeah, you'd love to think we were talking about a period of history that we'd learnt from and moved on from, and that with the reactions to each episode, I think it's very clear that there's a lot that has fundamentally hasn't shifted. And in fact, you know, a lot of political beliefs have calcified and you know, deepened.
Yeah, I think a moment in this finale that really drives that home is when Phyllis is talking about she's inflating her crowd size, which Davi told me was a real thing. But of course, you can't help but think of our current commander in chief when you think of that.
And for me, also, I wanted to know why someone who is profoundly lived in profound fear of the communist threat and actually saw the Equal Rights Amendment as being part of a communist conspiracy to destabilize the American military, why someone like Phyllis Schlafly would support someone like Trump, who's obviously got business dealings with Russians. So I think all of that stuff, where you get spat out of at the end of the series, I think thrusts you very much into where we are now. And that hopefully that encourages people to not only delve back in time and see, to reverse engineer like we wanted to do, like how we got here, but also we'll maybe look at where we are now with more informed, fresh eyes, you know, because we didn't just suddenly arrive here. It's been a gradual erosion, I think.
I know you all did a tremendous amount of studying of source material before you tackled the project. I myself, over the course of watching this show, have picked up one of Bella Abzug's books. I picked up The Sweetheart of the Silent Majority. But if you could recommend viewers to pick up one thing to sort of further their education or their relationship with this story, what would you suggest that they read or watch?
I think one of the most useful books to me, apart from Sweetheart of the Silent Majority, because in terms of getting into Phyllis, because that was an authorized biography, and it's sort of, it doesn't really fall on either side. I would read the Divided We Stand, which is the Marjorie Spruill book, because I think that really clearly lays out the central tenets of the struggle and the it's an intensely relevant book, I think, to read about, American democracy today. So I think that it's a really great read. It's really, you know, impeccably written. So I think that's probably what I would say. But also, I think I would encourage them to watch Chantal Ackerman. Mm. I think that's, even though it's not about secondary feminism per se, there's something about the life, that the stillness of the life, you know, that I find. And I still remember in high school reading in the women's room. But I would say Marjorie Spruill book was a really, really great read.
Two of the more perturbing moments for me in Phyllis's story was the moment where she slaps herself in an earlier episode, and then I think it's in that same episode where you deliver this really chilling "Thank you, Daddy" to Fred Schlafly, to John Slattery. Can you unpack those moments for Phyllis and sort of your performances of them, the slap and the "Thank you, Daddy"?
Well, when we were putting it together, we started off at 6 episodes, then it went to 8, and then it went to 9. And there were several flashbacks in Phyllis's story, and there was just so much story, meta story, not any one individual character arc, that it just felt right to jettison them. And when we were doing the argument scene, I just did the slap, because it's somehow, I guess, because of all my reading about her and reading about Phyllis's childhood, they felt there was a lot of suppression of feeling, and that something that she said a lot in interviews, that you don't show your love for people by playing the guitar and writing love poetry. You show your love by doing for people. So I feel like there was a lot of, I kind of reverse engineered that into her childhood and thought her mother worked 7 days a week. You know, her father was probably profoundly depressed from being retrenched, but yet was still the quote unquote patriarch of the family. I think that there was probably not a lot of time for her emotions. And I think that that's probably the way she parented. And I think it's the way her public persona was, that she was unruffled by things. She didn't she felt enervated. If anyone started on the other side started to get emotional, it gave her a lot of power in a way. So I think that her own sense of emotion and her relationship to her emotional life and her right to feel sadness or grief and all of those things, my actor's brain just went, it was that thing about shutting the door on all of those things, and anything that went wrong was her fault. And anything that was, you know, went well with her victory as well.
Right.
So it was just, I just thought it felt true to that stuff without going into any flashback to try and understand that. So I hope it gave something.
Oh, absolutely. It was very, very disturbing, and in a way that really enriches the story, I think. In this finale episode, Phyllis absolutely makes this choice, maybe that she'd already made long ago, to definitely go with Reagan over Phil Crane. There's this conversation, mm-hmm. this last conversation she has with Phil Crane. What in your mind is Phyllis deciding in that moment, in that last conversation with Phil, when he sort of reveals some aspects of his sexual proclivities, et cetera?
I think when you've climbed up the ladder, you can be more selective about who your friends are in a political sense. And I think in that moment, she's always, in the very first episode, we batted back and forth the whole thing about whether she was going to say to him, "Please stop touching my arm." You know, because he's obviously just always gently touching her in the way that women are often touched, which you find annoying, but you just rise on top of. And in the end, you get to the last episode and you think, I don't really need to deal with you anymore because I don't like you. You're not the moral man that I would choose to associate with. And so in a way, that's a friendship that's run its course. And when I say friendship, it's got big inverted commas around it.
Right.
So I think it's, in a way, Phyllis is for that moment in which she's feeling empowered and she's holding all the cards, she can play the more masculine role of saying, I'm done with that relationship, you know, which is normally inverted. And the irony, of course, is that then she ends up being treated, you know, shown the door because she's no longer useful because she's too polarizing.
Right.
So Reagan took her mailing list, but he didn't want the negative associations with her. But it happened in the 90s with a very polarizing female figure in Australian politics, a grassroots, very different character to Phyllis, called Pauline Hanson, who started what was called the One Nation Party, and the then Prime Minister, John Howard, I was thinking, why is he not shutting her down? Because her language is so xenophobic and ill-informed and inflammatory. And I now realize, of course, what he was doing was he was letting her hang herself politically, but not necessarily shutting the door on her supporters. But when she did hang herself politically, he hoovered all her supporters up. Wow. And so I think that's what often happens to polarizing figures in politics like Phyllis, is that they become the mouthpiece and enliven and provoke a whole swathe of fear-filled, rhetoric and that buoys up our base of selves. Yet the person in charge doesn't need to speak to that, but they can actually absolutely welcome in those followers. And I think that that's a very similar space that Phyllis found herself in, ironically.
I don't know if you feel, I've heard some performers talk about this. I don't know if you feel this way, that occasionally they'll miss a character that they put away. Is there anything about playing or inhabiting Phyllis that you miss?
She was a quintessential outsider. I mean, she was outside the political system. She was, being a mother of six and being so passionate about politics, she had a lot of close friends. And I don't think she organized. While she galvanized a lot of women through the language of fear, she didn't. It was a very pyramidal structure. So I found it intensely lonely, if I'm honest, to play Phyllis. Profoundly lonely. Even though surrounded by gorgeous women, wonderful John Slattery is my partner in crime, and Jean Triplehorn and Sarah and Melanie, everyone. That was great. It was lonely. Really lonely. And so I don't miss that at all, to be honest. I would look at the rushes of the feminists and think, oh my goodness, look at the fun they're all having. So there's not a lot that I miss. And I don't miss living with fear and paranoia and to spend one's life trying to prevent people from living their lives. Very negative space, to be honest.
I would imagine that would be a character you'd be happy to put away, but you mentioned watching the rushes of the feminist scenes, and I did have a question here for you about if there was one moment of the series that you weren't acting in, but watching, in the vein of producer or even as an audience member, one thing that you most wish you could have been a part of in the series that you weren't.
I love all of the scenes between Margot and Rose, and it went where we how we'd organised sets were in Toronto where we're filming was that Bella Abzug's and Gloria's apartment was divided by a corridor, and then there was the Schlafly's dining room and kitchen. And so every time I'd walk onto set, I'd just want to veer left and sit in Bella Abzug's sofa and walk into and lie on Gloria's bed. And then I had to turn right, no pun intended, and go into the kitchen. And I really felt that most acutely, I think, when I played that last scene, which was a bit of an homage to Jean Dielman, the Chantal Akerman film, into the kitchen. And I'm thinking, I really am turning far, far to the right and leaving so much potential sisterhood behind.
All right, that does it for our journey through Mrs. America, Richard. I mean, until September. Where can folks find you?
Well, I mean, they kind of took my idea for an anti-feminist Gilbert and Sullivan parody, so I kind of have to throw all that out and start writing a new musical, because Broadway is going to come back and they're going to need shows. And I figure, why not finally make my true political leanings known in musical theater form? So I'll be working on that. I will be, as ever, on Little Gold Men, our other podcast, which you'll be popping in at least once during the summer, and reviewing and doing all manner of other things. Actually writing something of a little feature on, one of the ancillary actors on this show. I won't tell you who, but so look forward to that. And I know where you're gonna be. You're gonna be slaving over a typewriter doing the book thing, which I have done. It's miserable. Well, have fun.
Thanks.
And yours actually requires research, I'm told.
Allegedly. I'll be on book leave. I'll be doing that. You can, yeah, please don't deprive yourself of Richard's voice. You can hear him over on Little Gold Men. You will enjoy that. I pre-recorded a bunch of interviews for Little Gold Men. So I'll, you know, you'll hear me talking to some folks over there across the summer. So yeah, listen to that podcast. It's a great podcast. Katie Rich, Mike Hogan, Richard Lawson holding it down for Little Gold Men over the summer. And we'll be back in September. You'll find me avoiding working on my book by tweeting at Joe Wrote This. And, until the fall, we don't have a like catchphrase. I want to be like, stay tuned, keep watching, something like that.
Yeah. Stay America.
Great.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.